This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good afternoon and welcome to Keeping the Faith. Unfortunately, Steve is out of town on business, and I'm filling in for him. My name is Don Nolan, and I've been here before, and so I hope you will enjoy the program this afternoon. We're privileged to have several students with us today from United Students Against Sweatshops, Chris Dressel, Victoria Davis, and Caitlin Burgo. Thanks for being with us. Before we get started, however, there is a National Weather Service a bulletin that says in Romeoville, that has issued a bulletin in Romeoville, a severe thunderstorm warning for southeastern Livingston County in central Illinois, north central Ford County in east central Illinois, and this will last until 5:30 p.m. Central Daylight Time. At 4:46 p.m. Central Daylight Time, National Weather Service Doppler radar indicated a severe thunderstorm located near Fairbury. It is moving northeast at 30 miles per hour. The storm is capable of producing nickel-size hail. Another thunderstorm capable of producing nickel-size hail was located in north-central Ford County, 2 miles north of Piper City. Severe thunderstorms will be near Forest by 4:55 p.m., Chatsworth by 5:05 p.m., and Cullum by 5:15 p.m. So be on the lookout for that severe weather. All right. Again, thank you very much for being with us. Our guests are from the United Students Against Sweatshop. We have Chris, Victoria, and Caitlin, and we're going to discuss this relatively new organization's activities here on the University of Illinois campus. I believe you're all University of Illinois students. Is that right?
Yes.
You're all undergraduates?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about how United Students Against Sweatshops got started here on campus, and then a little bit about what your connection is with the larger national organization.
Okay. Here on campus, groups had in the past been working with the university about workers' rights, but we had no definite organization. However, Caitlin and I, we were put in touch with the national organization during the summer of 2004, and we were invited to a conference in Washington, D.C., where we learned, you know, what the national organization was doing, what other people were doing on their campuses, and they gave us a network and a support system that allowed us to come back here and start our organization, which we did so by flyering, finding people who were interested in the cause, and just setting up informational sessions for that whole first semester. It was relatively very successful, actually. We managed to hold a conference here from a Midwest conference, and over, like, 30 different schools came from all around the Midwest, and that was our first semester here on campus. And since then, we've developed relatively strong ties with our administration that has allowed us to approach a lot of the topics with them that we want to see passed or discussed in our administration.
Well, I hope we can explore some of those topics as we go along. This is a call-in show. Just want to let our listeners know. If you would like to call in with any questions as we go along through the coming hour, feel free to call 333-9455 or 333-WILL. Or you can also call an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. So we hope to hear from you. You obviously have national ties, national connections. How old is the national organization? I take it it, too, is called United Students Against Sweatshops?
Yeah, that's correct. The national organization has existed in its official form since 1997. And what it does is serve as an umbrella organization that unites student groups like ours on individual campuses with each other and allows us to, like, network with each other. And also, like, it allows us to coordinate what we, like the demands we have for our administration, which makes it a much stronger effort with that many voices involved and compels university officials to listen more when they know that other university officials are under the same kind of pressure.
How many universities across the country are involved?
Over 200 campuses mm-hmm. across the university have university chapters in some form or another. Some are more in touch with the national organization, some are less in touch.
And there's some examples of some of the larger?
Every school in the Big Ten has them. Mm-hmm. Purdue actually has one of the most active ones in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And so ours is relatively new, but we're hoping to be very active.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get interested personally in this organization here at the U of I?
How I came to know the national organization was I worked with migrant farm workers down in Florida mm-hmm. on a kicking Taco Bell off campuses campaign because they had problems with the tomatoes that they were buying from workers who were exploited. And this was one of the campaigns that USAS was talking about nationally. And people contacted me when they knew I wanted to do something like that around the University of Illinois. So I was contacted by the national organization and asked to start one on U of
I. And Caitlin, how did you get involved?
Well, I had been looking into different groups like this on campus or different people who had been interested in these issues, and I never really found one that seemed like a particular cause that students could get involved with and really make some change while you're on campus, because everyone seems to kind of focus on either issues that are too big to tackle on a campus level. And so Victoria got in touch with me as someone who might be interested in starting the group over that summer, and we both thought it would be a really great idea and that we could make a lot of changes through university apparel and through those things, try and stimulate change in the wider industry.
And Chris?
Well, I suppose I was one of the successes of their advertisement campaign during the first semester.
What are you, the poster boy?
When I came to campus, I knew these were, you know, issues that I was concerned about and wanted to get involved with. And so when I found out that they had started a group like that, I just became involved.
Mm-hmm. Why should U of I students care about sweatshops?
I think what most of them don't realize is that almost everything they wear is made in sweatshops. A lot of them do not realize that the apparel they purchase in bookstores was made in sweatshop-like conditions in other countries. They also do not realize that it happens in the United States. To a lot of people, sweatshops is like something that happened early on in United States history, but we've been rid of it for a long time, and it only happens in really, really poor countries across the world. That's actually not true. It happens right here in our country, and I think that's a reason. And we buy products of sweatshop labor. I really think students need to be aware, if they're going to be able to make these consumer decisions, of what goes on behind the clothes.
And if a student says, it doesn't make any difference to me?
I guess there might possibly be some people that you couldn't reach with this message, but I think a lot of students, including people in our group, we take a lot of pride in the university, and I think that's something that we'd like to reach people with and say, look, you know, we sell a lot of apparel, and people are obviously very proud. You can tell by the amount of Illinois apparel that people wear, and I think that it would be, for students like us who really care about these issues, we would love to be able to, you know, wear our school logo proudly and you know, purchase things at the bookstores and feel pride that you know, our university is taking a stand on these important issues, and we can, you know, display the logo and, you know, show that we have pride.
So that we're clear, I think everybody has sort of a rough image of what a sweatshop is, but you want to pin that down a little bit? What exactly is your definition of a sweatshop, or are there many variations?
I'd say there's definitely many variations. I mean, the things that I feel like most come to mind when people talk about sweatshops are like child labor, forced overtime, sexual harassment, the lack of the ability to organize is a big one that we focus on campus, because we feel like that's a way for workers to change these other conditions on their own and through their own power. And so those are definitely some of the issues that come to mind.
I would completely agree that the right to form unions, the right to organize, and the right for collective bargaining is the biggest issue we're concerned about, because taking that away limits any possibility of workers taking their employment into their own hands and improving their own situation.
Now, you say the sweatshops in the United States. What percentages do you have of U.S. firms using onshore sweatshops as opposed to overseas?
I personally have seen workers in the fields. I mean, farm labor is not really regulated as much as it is in other industries here.
So you include farm work in the category of sweatshops?
Farm work, yes. I mean, that our group is focusing on apparel, but farm work is how I originally got involved, so I am very concerned about that. But yes, I would include that. But also, there's a lot of undocumented workers who work in sweatshops, especially in LA's fashion industry, et cetera. And because they're undocumented and because they're scared of being deported or something like that, they're able to not pay them, not regulate them, et cetera.
What's the percentage of undocumented workers in these? Do you know?
I have read articles that say, especially in the Los Angeles garment industry, almost 90% of the workers are undocumented.
Do they have a right to unionize?
I believe so. I believe so, yeah. I think it's a fundamental human right to try and better yourself, better your working situation.
Mm-hmm. Campaigns are you working on right now? What's the focus of your organization?
Well, we have two specific issues that we're working on this year. The first is to ensure that university apparel is made in non-sweat conditions, that is, conditions where workers have the right to unionize and aren't victimized. And the second campaign is that we're working to make the university cut its contract with Coca-Cola, because we feel that Coca-Cola...
You mean eliminate the
contract? We want the university to eliminate. Currently, the university has an exclusive relationship with Coca-Cola, so the only soft drinks that can be sold on campus are Coca-Cola products. We want Coca-Cola completely gone because of their human rights violations.
And, so Pepsi can't sell on campus? Is that
that's correct.
The deal?
Yeah.
Interesting.
There's actually, I know Chris was talking about it last week, there's actually some sort of, within the contract with Coca-Cola, it says any campus student organization who has an event and uses Pepsi products at their event can suffer sanctions from the university as a student organization. I mean, the contract is really... really exclusive, and it's frightening on its own, I think, to a lot of people, but that's not our reason for telling them to cut the contract. Our reason is because there have been documented violations of human rights by Coca-Cola in India, Colombia, and Turkey, including, you know, destruction of the environment, and also conspiring to eliminate union activities in Colombia.
And that's the reason? It's not because they're in competition with Pepsi?
Right.
So you're not arguing for diversity of soft drinks. You're just.
I mean, individually, I would argue for diversity of soft drinks, but the reason that our group is so concerned about it is because of the human rights violations
of
Coca-Cola. Right.
What are some of those exactly?
There are two main countries in which Coke has committed very serious human rights violations. The first is in Colombia. As you may know, Colombia is one of the least unionized countries in the world. Basically, that's because, you know, paramilitary right-wing organizations have been known to commit acts of violence, murder, and torture against union organizers. Since 1986, over 4,000 union members have been killed in Colombia. Our concern is that in the Coke bottling plant in Colombia, since 1989, there have been at least eight union workers who have been assassinated, and other workers have been subject to violence and intimidation for their union activities. And we think the Coca-Cola company has been, their subsidiary that operates the bottling plant in Colombia has been involved in, you know, sponsoring these paramilitary organizations to suppress union activities. In 1993, for example, 1,400 workers in the Coke bottling plants were members of the Sinaltrinal Union, which represents the workers there. By 2004, that number had dropped to about 400. Now the vast majority of workers are not even formally employed by Coke. They're 90% are basically like flexible employees. They're contracted through some like subcontracting scheme, so they really don't have the right to organize. And the, you know, Coke has... you know, obviously Coke is benefiting from these relationships because the number of union workers have dropped. And so this is part of the Coke company's campaign to profit off.
How much of Coke is made in the United States versus out of, do you know?
Well, most of the Coke that you buy is made locally. So, like, the Coke that you buy here is probably made somewhere in Illinois or at least in the Midwest. Our problem is that, the Coke company operates all around the world, and we think that the violations that have occurred in Colombia and India make it such that we don't want the university to have a continuing relationship with that company.
Just off the top of my head, have Coke officials said that's not our fault, blame Colombia?
That's precisely the argument that they use. Basically, the Coke company has a sort of scheme where its subsidiaries internationally are not wholly owned by the Coke USA. So, like, the Coke company that operates the Colombian bottling plant is called Coke FEMSA. It's based in Mexico, and Coke USA owns, like, just under a 50% share of the company. So effectively, they have control over what's going on, and they're profiting off what's going on. But then they come back and say, oh, no, we're slightly less than 50% ownership in this company, so we're not responsible for what's going on.
Let's come back to that in just a minute. Just another notice. The National Weather Service in Romeoville has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for southeastern Livingston County in central Illinois, north central Ford County in east central Illinois until 5:30 p.m. Central Daylight Time. At 4:46 p.m. Central Daylight Time, the National Weather Service Doppler radar indicated a severe thunderstorm located near Fairbury and moving northeast at 30 miles per hour. This storm is capable of producing nickel-sized hail, and another thunderstorm capable of producing nickel-sized hail was located in north central Ford County, 2 miles north of Piper City. Severe thunderstorms will be near Forest by 4:55 p.m., should already have been passing over, Chatsworth by 5:05 p.m., and Cullum by 5:15 p.m. So please heed those warnings. how do you go about assessing responsibility of American companies working in other countries? What are you have some sort of criteria for verifying that the company could do something about the abuses that it's complicit in by producing and operating within that country?
I think our point is that, you know, we have like an ethical responsibility that, you know, as consumers or as when the university acts as a consumer, that it's not, you know, sponsoring human rights violations. The arrangement that Coca-Cola, for example, has in Colombia is pretty much it allows them to benefit legally. But they functionally they have, you know, control over what goes on in the Coke bottling plant in Colombia. So we think Coke's arguments, well, they might be, you know, convincing to a judge or something who's bound to, you know, interpret the rule of, like, law. We think functionally they're responsible for what's going on. They're profiting from it. They control what goes on in these plants. So that's why we think Coca-Cola is responsible for what's going on in Colombia.
Mm-hmm. I would also add one of the main successes of USAS nationally has been the formation of the Workers' Rights Consortium, which is an independent monitoring agency that responds to specific worker complaints in factories. Mm-hmm. And
worldwide or just the U.S.?
Worldwide. No, worldwide.
Worldwide.
And it is through the, like, results and reports from the WRC that we can gain specific details about what is going on in these factories, what is happening with these companies, maybe even how much the company knows about what's going on in these specific factories. And then universities such as ours that are affiliated with the WRC, meaning they have agreed to abide by the results and the reports they give them, listen to the reports, listen to the results, and then can tell what their licensees essentially have been up to, mm-hmm. and where the apparel is being produced. So agencies like the Workers' Rights Consortium also aid in the monitoring that you were talking about.
How do they go about doing this? How do they collect this information?
Well, basically, the way the Workers' Rights Consortium works is they respond to workers' complaints. They aren't a group that goes out and does a broad sweeping monitoring of factories. They try to keep channels open in countries around the world where apparel manufacturing is focused, and channels of communication so that if workers can make a complaint to them if they feel that there isn't a way, or make a complaint to a representative in that area. If they feel there's no way to make a complaint to their manager, or if they feel that they are in danger. And then the Workers' Rights Consortium, and in turn, communicates these complaints to Students Against Sweatshops and to university officials who are involved with them. And our whole practice as a group is to try and work in solidarity with what the workers feel is necessary for them to improve their conditions. It's not our idea isn't to tell the workers that this is what's going to be better for you, and this is what we're going to demand of our administrations. What we try and do is transfer these complaints that workers have and things that workers would say would better their situation, and then kind of turn that into a demand that we can make of our university.
Mm-hmm. Have they had successes in causing change?
There have been successes. One of the first successes was establishing what we call as a code of conduct, a licensee's code of conduct. And the University of Illinois got their code of conduct in 2000, I believe. And what this basically says is it's focused on the ability of workers to organize, and it basically says that employees of our licensees or of subcontractors of our licensees should always have the ability to organize freely. And there are also other stipulations. The problem is holding these companies responsible to this code of conduct and making sure that's a big part of our job as Students Against Sweatshops, is to say, look, to the administration, this company has violated our code of conduct that we've agreed to. Now mm-hmm. we need to sever our relationship with this company. And that's a big part of the problem, is there's always a lot of reluctance to sever a relationship, a business relationship with a company who makes university apparel. And so that's where we come in and say, we're not going to let this code of conduct just kind of be a lame document. We're going to enforce it and make sure that it's used.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller on line one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Yes. I'm over 70 years old, but I wanted to know one question. How do you think this congeals with Keeping the Faith? How do you think it connects with Keeping the Faith? You've mentioned ethics. You mentioned Coca-Cola. You mentioned a group. How do you think it connects? And I'll hang up. Today is a worldwide community, so I know that's an important thing, that this is worldwide. And I'll hang up and listen to your answer, and thanks.
Let me just give a little spin on that. Are you aware of religious organizations that are involved in this kind of activity? And why should a Christian or a Jew or anyone else in a religious tradition care?
I think a big part of it is I think people of any faith can relate to empathy towards the conditions of workers and towards the conditions of people around the world. And I think that's a big part of the feelings of our group, is that there are definitely religious people across the world who are working in similar causes, either on missions or through charity groups or things like that. And I really feel that it is, I mean, for people of faith, it's a really important cause, because it is something like, it has to do with feeling part of a world community and part of brotherhood with people around the world. And that's in solidarity with people who you might not know or ever get to meet, but who are also, living beings that we should care about and really try to help if we can. And that's really our goal as a group on the university campus.
Mm-hmm. Just one second here. Make sure that our callers are aware. If you would like to call in to pose a question on the work of the United Students Against Sweatshops, feel free to call in. The number is 333-9455, 333-WILL, or you can call 1-800-222-9455. We have another caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Hello? Hello? Are you there? Okay, thank you. All right, let's pursue that theme just a little bit. What do you make of the religious principle that you find in many traditions, that we are our brother's keeper? Do you buy that view? I mean, this ties in with the caller's comment that there is a connection here to what this program is about.
I personally agree with that. I mean, I feel that as human beings, we are sort of all connected in the human condition. We are all, even if you can't see it, like, it's not an obvious connection. I do think that what is going on across the world does somehow affect us. And mm-hmm. also it's just caring about other human beings is the base, you know, caring about other human beings, caring about their condition in life is a reflection of our internal condition. You know, like, we should not want to see others suffer. We shouldn't even accept that the suffering is a necessary evil, because I don't believe it is.
You think this is a universal principle, ethical principle, that all religions share? I don't know if you want to go there or not, but the caller pushed us in that direction.
No, I mean, I as far as being your brother's keeper, I think it's, even if it is a matter of faith or if it's just a matter of conscience or something, if you wanted to go along those lines, I think, like, we care a lot about people in our community, and I think it's really important to see it as a world community and to feel that your life isn't, you know, caring about you and the people who are related to you and people close to you, but also caring about people around the world, and that's, I think, a big part of what we put into our group and our work.
We have a caller on line one.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I just want to address the last caller. First of all, as a Christian, I'd like to remind her that as a morality issue, how we act and the reasons why, this is something that is a Christian and other religion-based issue. Number two, I'd like to thank the volunteers who are there today as guests for addressing this issue in an educational facility that's supposed to promote higher learning and labor issues and education for all. And I'd like to praise you for enforcing and educating the community on these issues. And go Coca-Cola, anti-Coca-Cola campaign.
Thank you very much for your comments.
Thanks a lot. You're welcome.
Why don't we pick up this theme on whether or not we are a brother's keeper a little bit. There are those who advocate globalization, a neoliberal approach to globalization, on the grounds that it creates wealth and creates opportunity and jobs, and that any attempt to inhibit or restrain that effort is problematic. How do you respond to those?
Well, I think the point that we're trying to emphasize is that, like, we can point to, like, you know, the material conditions there in these sweatshops and you know, the conditions in which these workers live, and say that that's not acceptable and that we have to try and do something about it. I think everyone agrees with, like, even people who adhere to, like, a neoliberal paradigm of economics agree that, you know, poverty is not good and that human suffering isn't good. I think that our differences represent different ways of trying to solve that problem. I think the most strident advocates of globalization think that inevitably these problems are going to go away and that we just need to stick to our guns, and that by that I mean, you know, the neoliberal economic development paradigm. I think one of the arguments that's frequently made is to point to countries like the United States that in which labor conditions have improved. Certainly in the United States, as we've indicated, they're not good by any stretch of the imagination, but it's not like 1913 when you could respond to a strike in the United States by, like John D. Rockefeller did to mine workers, by pulling out some Gatling guns and shooting their families anymore.
That wasn't exactly taking care of your brother.
Right. And I think, you know, the point that people make is, look, in the United States, we stuck to, you know, our program of economic development, and now, look, things are different. I think that sort of ignores, you know, why things are better in the United States than, say, they were when industrialization was new in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And that, a lot of it, in my opinion, is because of social movements, and mainly, you know, movements for unionization. And that's what we're trying to foster in our work. Globalization isn't going to make things better unless there are, you know, committed people working to address, you know, the negative aspects of that. And that's, I think, where the context that we see our work in.
Unmonitored, unconstrained globalization. Mm-hmm. We have another caller. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Your question?
Yeah, hi. I first wanted to just say thank you to the USAS people for being on the show, as well as you for having them on the show. And I had two questions. One, I was hoping that they could talk a little more about the stuff that's going on that Coca-Cola is doing in India. And second, I just wanted to know if you have regular meetings and what your contact information is.
Thank you.
I'll say the quick things first. Our regular meetings are at 8 p.m. every Wednesday at the University YMCA, and we'd love to have anyone, students or community members who are interested in these issues, attend. Again, that's 8 p.m. every Wednesday night at the University YMCA on the corner of Wright and Chalmers. I'm glad that you asked about the conditions regarding coke in India. Essentially, coke's violations of human rights in India consist of its, poor stewardship of the environment there, and there are basically a number of components. First of all, these bottling plants in India have had the effect of over-exploiting the water resources there. So in some places, like 6 months after the bottling plants are built in India, we've seen like water table levels drop 100 feet or more, which is a problem in, largely agrarian regions in which, people get their water from wells, and which access to that water is critical to for their subsistence agriculture. Another problem with coke in India is regards, their pollution. A coke bottling plant in India uses around 1 million liters of water a day. A lot of that water, a lot of it goes into the product, but a lot of it is processed through the plant in the manufacturing process and then put back into the environment. And usually when it's put back in the environment, it's very polluted and dirty. Also, there's solid waste. So a lot of these bottling plants produce solid waste that contains heavy metals like lead and cadmium. And so Coke was trying to figure out what should we do with all this solid waste. So their solution was to tell the local farmers that it made good fertilizer and then distribute it to them for free and then they could farm it through the land. I mean, you don't need to be an environmental scientist to know that that's not a good idea. But Coke didn't care. That was a way to get rid of it for free. Additionally, the products that
they
are made—
successful in doing that?
Well, the state government shut them down. But they try that for a while, and they don't care, and they'll do that until someone forces them not to. Another thing is that the products that they're made in India, the coke products, are not made to the same standards that they are in other places of the world. For example, a nonprofit, or I'm not sure if it was a nonprofit, but it's an independent organization, tested a lot of these products that were made in India, and they found that the pesticide levels in coke products in India were over 30 times greater than the legal limit allowed in the European Union. Mm-hmm. There was even one case in which a local an owner of an Indian grocery store in the United States tried to import coke products from India, and it was not allowed to be imported when it reached the port because it violated standards in the United States. And so right now in India, there's a large grassroots movement against Coca-Cola. The largest Coke bottling plant there has been shut down since, I think, March of 2004 by local residents.
I was going to ask you, how successful are indigenous movements in India? I understand that the Bhopal tragedy, the victims of that are still trying to get reparations.
I think the grassroots movement in India against Coca-Cola is very important. On the Colombian side, it's very hard because, like I said, there's a lot of violence against people who are involved in those sorts of movements. But in India, people have made this, their personal struggle because it affects them directly. And there's been, for over 1,000 days, there's been a 24/7 vigil in front of one of these plants because people are sick and tired of, their agricultural prospects being ruined by coke, their water being polluted. So this is a grassroots movement, and we see ourselves as, standing in solidarity with that movement.
Hold on just one second. If you would like to call in to pose a question about any of the topics we've discussed up to now, the number is 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Victoria?
I would also want to add to what Chris was saying, that these movements, these grassroots movements by the people in these countries, in these factories, also lends a certain sense of legitimacy to the campaigns, whereas if it were just college students saying, look what Coke has done, like Caitlin said, when we can partner with these campaigns that are already going, mm-hmm. all it does is raise their voice. It doesn't overshadow what they are doing in the country for themselves. So mm-hmm. I think it's very important that the campaigns, the struggle, it starts there because these are the people most affected by it. So it seems much more legitimate for them to voice their concerns about it.
Are there obstacles to them doing that?
Well, I think as Chris hit on, in India there has been a huge grassroots movement to close down these Coca-Cola bottling plants that have destroyed their environment. But in Colombia, it's almost...
Well, clearly there are there.
Right. And in Colombia, it's hard for these workers. I mean, they can't demonstrate in front of these factories, and they can't because they're so afraid that... Because what's happening in Colombia isn't environmental degradation. It's they're afraid for their lives because they work for Coca-Cola. And so it's too much to ask. I mean, you can't, you know, demand these sort of mass rallies from people who are afraid for their lives. So it's also, it also kind of, Coca-Cola might use that as a defense, saying, you know, these workers aren't making demands. You know, they're not complaining to the managers. Well, you can't expect them to. You know, you have to take into account the conditions of the country and the sort of political situations that a lot of these groups of people are in when they're trying to organize. So that's also a big part is... The only way our movement can work is through communication with people in these countries. And so we're always working with the Workers' Rights Consortium to get as much communication from places like Colombia, where it's hard to find out what's going on.
How would a worker in a Coca-Cola factory in Colombia get a complaint out safely to the Worker Rights Association?
Well, one of the only ways that I know about is that you can... There are Workers' Rights Consortium people who will go to these factories and try, and they have internships actually where they'll take students to different places.
In Colombia,
I'm not sure. They don't have internships in Colombia, but as far as apparel workers across the world, that's how a lot of the complaints get out. But in Colombia, there have actually been workers who received amnesty in the United States as refugees from Colombia and from the situation there, and that's how a lot of this have gotten out. Some of the leaders of the union group have come and brought their complaints as, you know, residents of the United States now because there really aren't lines of communication open from these workers to people in the U.S. or people who might, you know, help them in their own country.
I should probably note that there was a lawsuit filed against Coca-Cola several years ago in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida. And that suit was filed by the estate of one of the assassinated Coke workers and was filed on behalf of the International Labor Rights Fund and the Coke union there. Ultimately Coke, it's under appeal right now, but the district decision was that Coke USA was removed as a defendant because of lack of subject matter jurisdiction. It was filed under the Alien Tort Claims Act of 1789. So this is where Coke's argument that it's not responsible for what's happening in Colombia comes to play, because in response to the suit, they said that we're not a majority owner of this company in Colombia, so we're not responsible. But that is one. The suit was one way that, you know, the complaints in Colombia were given attention in the United States.
Mm-hmm. How do you all go about working on campus? What are the mechanics? The details? How did you how do you approach someone at the university to cause the university to rethink and hopefully cut its contract with Coke?
Well, as far as Coke and also the things we're doing with campus apparel, there's a committee called the Chancellor's Licensing Advisory Committee, and it's a committee of faculty and professors and student representatives who meet and talk about these issues, talk about issues that are coming forward in the university, to the university and their licensing policies. And that committee basically is the chancellor's eyes and ears as far as what's going on with this sort of thing in the university. And so basically our goal is to talk to people on the committee and talk to students on campus and try and get the more people know about on campus, the more people can talk to these people on the committee and talk to the chancellor and say that these are important issues. And as far as with Coca-Cola,
who would make the decision to...
The chancellor... As far as Coca-Cola, it's a very complicated decision because...
Wouldn't have to go to the board?
I'm not sure exactly if the Coca-Cola decision would have to go to the board, but there's a lot involved because of the athletic department also. There are separate contracts for the athletics and for the general Coca-Cola contract. So our contract actually expires in about a year and a half.
The university.
Right, the Coca-Cola contract with the university. And at the end of last year... the committee made a recommendation to the chancellor saying that if these matters weren't resolved, our obvious goal was for them to cut the contract immediately. But what we did get from the committee was to say that if this matter isn't resolved in a year and a half, we will not renew the contract and we will look for someone else to get a contract with.
So that was a commitment from?
That was a commitment from the chancellor from last year.
How does that compare with work on other campuses?
Other campuses, I know Rutgers was a big success story. They actually did get their contract cut with Coca-Cola, mm-hmm. and they had a really large student movement. A lot of people were really informed on the campus and got the contract cut. So that, but ours, I'm not sure if anyone has actually put forth a policy that's similar to ours, but I know, because a lot of these people have just gotten into 10-year contracts that are, I mean, you can't, in 10 years, you know, who knows where these issues will be at right now. So that's, it was a step in the right direction, but since we've been so absorbed in these issues and learning about all these terrible things that have happened, we don't really want to hang on to it for another year and a half, right. So.
There's a tipping point at some point where Coke, which is a very large firm, will be affected. I can't imagine that one or two or three contracts under threat might make a difference. Where is it that you see that it will have an impact on the company?
I think, I mean, even though one or two or three might not have an impact on them in a global sense, I think a contract like the University of Illinois would have a huge impact if the university took a stand and said, we're not going to take this anymore. You know, we're going to try and find someone who, you know, uses ethical business practices in the production of their products. And because they really, and the reason that I feel like our one university and other large universities obviously have a larger impact, but is because Coca-Cola has been sending public relations teams and, you know, marketing people to the universities to try and convince them that everything's okay, that there's no need to worry, you know, they have it all under control. And for the first couple of years of this investigation, they didn't do that. They just tried to blow the universities off and say, this isn't important, you know, they're never going to get anywhere with it. But then finally, after university officials, including officials from the University of Illinois, just said, we need to talk to Coca-Cola about this, or we are, you know, if you're not going to bargain with us at all or tell us what's going on, mm-hmm. we're going to, you know, either cut or take some sort of drastic action. Then they started sending out the teams of marketing representatives and people. And we had a meeting last year with five or six people from Coca-Cola. Our committee of 10 had a meeting with five or six representatives from Coca-Cola who, you know, really just put on a show telling us that, you know, the problem is with Colombia and it's a dangerous country. The problem isn't with Coca-Cola's business practices. And we just don't feel like that's the case. And the workers who communicate say that's not the case. So,
mm-hmm. Also, the impact that, say, the University of Illinois cutting the contract with Coke would not only be sending a message to Coke, but also to the other universities that have contracts with Coke. Like, I know our university officials are always concerned with what are other big schools doing, what else is going on in the Big Ten, what are other university officials thinking on this specific topic.
So much for sticking your neck out.
Right. So schools such as ours, where it is so large and so many other schools would be aware of what our specific policies are. Say, like, cutting our contract with Coke or even just not renewing it would send a large message and also kind of give other schools the chance to just follow suit if they're not willing to stick their neck out, which is often the case with large public universities mm-hmm. like this.
Is Columbia the only? Surely there are other places that there are problems with Coke, right? Columbia is just the most egregious one, or?
Well, Columbia, India, and Turkey.
Columbia, India, and Turkey?
Turkey, where's the also been? Mm-hmm. I don't know if Chris can elaborate on the situation in Turkey, but I think it also has a lot to do with situations with environmental degradation. And there's also, I'm sure, as far as, like, now that the heat is really on Coke and people are starting to look into these issues, there might be other places that haven't gotten attention that might come out. Mm-hmm. But Colombia has been, for the last, you know, almost 8 years, it's been really, these things have started happening and come to light, and we've really been talking about them.
Now, when Coke produces Coke in Turkey, is it sold in Turkey?
That's basically the way their operation runs, is that.
So it's localized.
Yeah.
Right.
And so your rationale for holding the company, the multinational, responsible is? I'm just being devil's advocate here for a minute. If they behave themselves in Champaign County, that's not okay with you, right?
That's not sufficient for us because they're still profiting from what goes on in Columbia. They still have control over what goes on in Columbia. And the way we feel is that as students at a Coke campus, every time that, you know, you want a soft drink on campus, you're forced to subsidize, you know, gross violations of human rights. And we feel that's wrong, and that's why we hold them responsible for what goes on in Colombia. I should say, in response to your question about, like, which countries have problems, certainly, like, we've known about Colombia for a while. India, you know, Coke has only been operating in India since 1992, and that India has received a lot of attention because of the grassroots movement there. But what we find is that the way they work in, you know, Colombia or India is pretty much the way they work everywhere. And when you learn more about how their business practices in any other countries besides the, pretty much the industrialized Western countries, you find that they're pretty bad. This is just, you know, this is just the practice for Coke around the world. So in a way, it's sort of pointless to say which one is worse because it's pretty egregious anywhere you look.
Now, your two foci are apparels and Coke. Clearly, there are other companies out there. How did you arrive at these issues as opposed to, I mean, some years ago, back when South Africa was such a problem, a lot of folks were worried about that, and surely there are other areas. So how do you go about selecting?
I think a large part of our focus is things that we can affect as a university on campus. And I know a lot of us intend to, after we graduate, you know, go on to do social justice work either with labor rights or through other issues. But I think on campus our focus is really, we would really like to see a lot more students get involved with us and a lot more students care and realize that universities, if universities took action on the 200 campuses where there are students against sweatshops, if those administrations took action, they could really be a wedge in the huge apparel industry because there is so much licensed apparel. And so anyways, I think that the way we get to these two campaigns is really from what we hear from the Workers' Rights Consortium are things that they feel like these are really important issues that students could have a big effect on campus, not just for publicity's sake, but could have a really honest effect on these workers' lives if we made these changes. So I think that's how we decide what we're going to do.
So you're concentrating your efforts on something that you can have a genuine impact on.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk a little bit about if a student's standing in Follett's and they're trying to decide whether or not to buy this apparel, what is it that they should have in mind a sweatshop is like? How bad is it? What are some of the conditions that should concern them?
Well, I think, as we were talking about earlier, it's just it can really run the gamut from things like child labor, which is sometimes the most visually accessible for a lot of people, or lack of ability.
Detail that a little bit.
Well, in some countries in East Asia, I know there have been situations where children are either kidnapped or sold from their families into factories that make clothing or sports equipment or things that can be sold to consumers in the United States and Western countries. And so it's not even just a situation where these children are working instead of being in school. It's a situation where they're also sometimes in slave-like conditions or forced to buy themselves out of these working conditions. And so those, I think, as far as I'm concerned, are some of the most egregious violations are when they involve children. Mm-hmm. But there's also situations of sexual harassment. In Mexico, there have been situations of I know a lot of people have heard about the border towns and the maquiladoras on the border, and women who walking home from plants at night and facing violence and sexual violence or sexual harassment in the plants. And it's a matter of feeling like we were talking about earlier about kind of a world community, like these things you wouldn't want happening to someone in your family. And as a feeling like if you're part of some sort of world family, you feel like you should stand up for people who are going through these things across the world. And that's kind of our way of doing this, is saying our university shouldn't be supporting these things in any way.
So the price on this sweatshirt in Follett's would not be what it is were there not those conditions.
Actually, yeah, that's correct. But I just think another thing that, you know, people should have in mind when you're, you know, considering whether to buy, you know, this hoodie or T-shirt from Follett's is not just how bad it is, but how relatively easy it would be to make things better. For example, like if a $20 like Nike hoodie, for example, that would be sold in Follett's or in Atlanta Union Bookstore. Just by increasing the price of that item like 25 cents, that price could either be, you know, covered by the brand or it could be passed on to the consumer. But regardless, for 25 cents, you could essentially double the wage of the worker that made that item of clothing. So that's, you know, you should think about how bad it is. But also, as a concerned consumer, you should also think about, you know, how relatively cheap it would be to make things better for these workers.
We have a caller in line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Yeah, first I'd like to make a quick comment. Coca-Cola has been doing this kind of stuff for a long time. There's a book entitled Trade Unionists Against Terror, And it's mostly about Coca-Cola in Guatemala. And the book refers to people being kidnapped, threats, assassination attempts, everything else. And I have a question. Is there a general boycott against Coca-Cola?
Thank you.
Well, thanks for recommending that book. And like I said, you know, you mentioned Guatemala. And this is pretty much the way Coke operates all over the world. But regardless, some organizations have called for boycotts against Coke. There are local boycotts in a number of countries. What we do as students against sweatshops is we want to put, you know, pressure on the university. I personally don't buy Coca-Cola products, and I don't think most members of our group do. But I think the most effective thing that we can do as students is to is to pressure our administrators to cut the contract, because that's something that Coca-Cola is really going to be concerned about more than if just one person or two people decided, you know, if you personally decide not to buy Coke, although that's not to say that you shouldn't make a conscientious decision not to drink Coke products.
I think it's really, I think a boycott would, if we could get it organized with a huge amount of people, would really send a message to Coke. But the organization is really a big part of our problem, and it's a part of... we had a whole week of education out on the quad a few weeks ago, and just handing flyers out to people and trying to get people to talk to us about issues on campus is really not difficult, but it's hard to get people to really care. And, you know, every day we would find probably 3 to 5 people who really seemed interested in our cause, but that isn't enough to, at least on our campus, to have a boycott that would really be persuasive to Coke. So I think going through a sort of asking for a university boycott.
Just 1 second. We have a caller in line 2. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Thank you. I have actually 2 points to make. One, I wanted to thank you for actually having the speakers that you have today. I think it's an excellent opportunity for people to find out more about the egregious acts of Coke. Second, there is actually going to be a speaker next Sunday at 10 o'clock in the morning at Altgeld Hall 245, and his name is Dr. Sandeep Pandey. He's been quite closely associated with the grassroots movement of anti-Coke movement in India, in Uttar Pradesh, and he's going to give a talk called Global Capital, Local Liability, Impact of Neoliberal Policies on Education and Social Mobilization in India. And he's been quite closely associated with the movement, so if your listeners really are interested, they could find out more about what's going on in that front. Thank you.
Thank you for that announcement.
Oh, Victoria? To go off of what Caitlin was saying earlier about the boycott, it would really be difficult to organize and understandably difficult to ask students to participate in, especially the thousands who live in university residence halls. How can you possibly eat dinner? How can you do any of this? You would have to do it without drinking, because that is the only product available as, like, refreshments in the dorms, etc. I mean, it's really the only product, soft drink-wise, you can buy on campus, like in the quad shop, in the union, pretty much everywhere. And that makes it really difficult, especially for those students who do live on campus, to, whether they agree with it or not, participate in a boycott that we may have called. So, the exclusive contract itself almost, like, forbids the possibility of a successful boycott. So,
are there boycotts going on elsewhere around the country, or efforts to do that?
I think on some of the campuses where they do have a stronger group, they're working towards a campus-wide boycott. I think our focus has really definitely been on education and kind of awareness, because if we could get enough people aware to mobilize a boycott, I think that would be great. But really, the idea would be just for everyone to know, even people who don't care on campus, for everyone to know that this is going on, and this is why these students are out here, you know, distributing these flyers and having these events and having great speakers come and talk about these issues, is because this is important and because it's something that affects our university, instead of just kind of, you know, why are there flyers here against Coca-Cola? I wish more people on campus would know, even if people didn't really care. Although I hope everyone would care.
There's an organization called Fair Labor Association, and it lists as a motto of sorts, I suppose, without transparency, there's no accountability. Without accountability, there's no responsibility for change. It sounds to me like that's more or less what you're trying to work toward.
The Fair Labor Association is a group of corporations and universities who have taken up the cause of monitoring labor practices. However, a lot of their policy calls for voluntary corporate monitoring, which is, I mean, you're asking Coke to monitor Coke. And
the fox to guard the chickens.
Right. That's really why we prefer the Workers' Rights Consortium as a monitoring agency, because they do do independent monitoring. They're not related to a corporation, although the University of Illinois is affiliated with the Fair Labor Association. We are a member of it, and we do choose to abide by its policies, although we don't feel that they're strict enough. We also don't feel that their code is strong enough to be enforced. It's a very weak and vague code, and it makes it very difficult for strict accountability.
They talk about a culture of compliance, but yet all around us those requirements for compliance seem to not be enforced.
I think that's one of the problems in the garment industry, and that's with the Fair Labor Association, and that's why this semester we're working on how to make the requirements that we have on paper on our code of conduct be manifested in the actual practices in the industry. And the way that we think we're going to be able to do that is by the Workers' Rights Consortium is now developing a list of factories that are actively compliant with these codes of conduct that permit union organizations, and that would be good places to have university apparel manufactured. So approximately 40 universities this past Wednesday asked their administrators to consider a proposal whereby all the licensees, companies such as Nike, Adidas, et cetera, anyone that makes university apparel, would be required to manufacture a certain percentage of their apparel in these designated factories, the ones that have been designated by the Workers' Rights Consortium as good places to manufacture clothing.
And who did this? A group of 40 universities?
Yes, 40 universities who are members of United Students Against Sweatshops. Mm-hmm. And so this is a way that we can guarantee that at least a certain percentage, and the percentage will gradually increase year by year, that a certain percentage of our apparel will be made in conditions that are objectively sweat-free conditions.
Gotcha. So your idea is if you just keep focused on this, you can cause some effective change, even though there are lots of other battles out there to fight.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
This is where we feel we're the most effective, yes.
Because it's the most visible to students?
Yes, but also because it's where we have people who are forced to listen to us. Effectively, we are consumers or customers of the university, which operates as a business. And because we are the ones paying them, et cetera, they are forced to be accountable to us. They are forced to listen to us. Mm-hmm. And so this is where we think students can affect the most change.
Well, very good. Well, I want to thank you all for joining us. It was a lively conversation, good questions, and I wish you well in your work. We have had today Chris Dressel, Victoria Davis, and Caitlin Burgo, who are representing the United Students Against Sweatshops, an organization that's been at work on the U of I campus for the past 2 years. Is that right?
Right. That's correct.
Well, good luck with your work.
Thank you
for joining us.
Thank you for
listening to Keeping the Faith. I'm Don Nolan.
My ears are steady.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Imagine Superman, demented with age, on a final mission to save the world. Or Conan the Barbarian, civilized and living in L.A., boarding the bus with a good book. It's all there in the poetry of Charles Harper Webb. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, Words Fly on the Peabody Award-winning program To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7, here on AM 580, WILL Urbana. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Andy's Hallmark, with cards, gift wrap, and candies, and The Reading Group, a nonprofit clinic helping children and youth with reading and writing problems, on the web at readinggroup.org.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms this evening. The low in the lower 60s with south winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high in the upper 80s and south winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-60s and south winds around 10 miles per hour. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.